There we are, another freezing cold day in the Big Smoke. Bob McCown, John Shannon with you.
Nobody cares. There's people on the beach in Mexico listening. You know?
Well, good for them.
Yeah. Hawaii.
Yeah, don't
Florida.
Don't get bit by any bugs or animals or fish.
What are you talking about?
Well, I hope they all do. So I was up late last night. I watched the Shapovalov match with Nadal.
And were you yelling at the referee too?
Not so much.
No.
I think Shapo had a point, but for the most people would not have watched it, or at least haven't watched it yet. I imagine there was a replay on today, but that's usually how they do it. But the match started at 10:30 or something. And looked like a blowout in the first two sets, and yeah. Shapo managed to hang in there. I don't know. Should we be encouraged by this kind of performance or disappointed that he's not yet at age 22 been able to kind of get over that hump?
How about both? Maybe. I mean, how about both? I mean, listen, I think we regale people with that a guy like Dennis is playing a guy like Nadal at the Australian Open in the quarterfinals. But the learning curve never stops. I mean, I last night, my first thought was when it all occurred was that it's just like a veteran player in professional sports getting the break, getting, you know, the benefit of the doubt. But at the same time, I liked in many ways Shapovalov's reaction to what happened, simply because there's some courage there and there's some confidence there. And I think that, well, he may not get a break from an umpire for a while. I think that there's something positive to take out of the experience about playing somebody like Rafael Nadal.
It is. The one thing that I thought was interesting is I can't remember the last time there was any kind of controversy with a chair official or with an official in tennis. It happens so rarely. I mean, guys do get mad every once in a while, but you now have, I mean, we have no line judges at this major championship. People aren't complaining. Players aren't complaining. And maybe principally because there's no point. And, you know, back in the days of McEnroe, et cetera, you used to get arguments between players and chair umpires all the time.
Yeah, but let's remember, Bob.
That's
let's
rare.
Remember, you know, the thing about tennis might be the most technologically advanced professional sport going. The simplicity of it and the Hawkeye system that they use has really changed any of those arguments, really changed how a player has that, well, I'm getting cheated. And, you know, to quote John McEnroe, are you blind? But Hawkeye is so good and so effective, and you can see the results in arena. You know, it's one of those things where you say, hey, listen, there are fewer arguments because for that reason alone.
Well, and to that point, I honestly would not be surprised if we saw the elimination of line judges.
Well, there's only one place that they will never eliminate them, I think.
Wimbledon.
Yeah. Yeah. Because it's part of the tradition.
Well, maybe.
Yeah.
But, you know, you would have said Wimbledon won't have put a roof on the place.
Yeah, but that's money. That's just money.
Well, I mean, I understand what you're saying, but I just think the system is now, it's not just that it's good, it's accepted.
Yes.
And the players don't seem to have a problem with it. And I think that's where the principal objection would come from.
Agreed.
And, you know, even Wimbledon, I understand its tradition, but I have a feeling that even they will succumb and we will see the absence, excuse me, of line judges. We're going to talk baseball today. Shai Davidi will join us. As most people may be aware, I would think, the Players Association countered Major League Baseball's first proposal And I guess the question is, was their counter significant enough to inspire significant discussion or negotiation? Or was it just a carrot up into the wind? We'll talk about it. Shai Davidi of Sportsnet will join us when we continue after these messages. We're back with our friend Shai Davidi of Sportsnet, who's joined us today as Major League Baseball, well, crawls towards the finish line in terms of a new collective bargaining agreement. Yesterday, I guess it was, the Players Association responded to the owner's latest proposal. We were talking about tennis off the top, Shai, and you know, this is sort of like a tennis match at the, in the beginning of the first set. You know, whether you're trying to score points, but really you don't, you know, you can't win in the first set, so you don't want to give too much away. What did you make of the, in general, of the proposal made by the Players Association?
Well, this is, in some ways, and I, you know, it was described to me as such, as, you know, like a the first sort of major step, because in essence, to this point, both sides have just been kind of swapping maximalist positions. Mm-hmm. And this is a bit of a move towards the owners. Now, you know, there's an expectation that the owners are going to respond today. And I'm very curious to see whether they're going to do something, they're going to take a step towards the players, or are they going to play tough? I think that to me will be a real indication of whether we're in for, you know, a possible resolution in a reasonable amount of time, or if this fight is going to be a lot more extended than that. So, you know, I think that you can't look at it as anything but hopeful, but, you know, there's still a massive, massive gap between these two sides.
Where did you see the movement from the players yesterday?
In just removing the free agent, the request that free agency be sped up earlier than 6 years of service time. You know, that was, you know, Commissioner Rob Manfred at his news conference when the lockout was announced made clear that was a red line, a complete non-starter for them. And I think ultimately players understood that was going to be a non-starter too. But, you know, this essentially, if you're kind of looking at this as, you know, a chessboard, this is sort of essentially just removing some of the pawns that were just going to get in the way of a resolution here. Right. And so now we're getting into a little bit more, a little clearer picture of where the sides are trying to get to and which issues are of primary importance. We know the owners want to keep some salaries down. They want to get the expanded playoffs. Those are the key things for them. You know, the players, you know, they had asked for a quicker path to free agency. That's off the table in all likelihood now. And so, you know, they're really locking in on, you know, something, some sort of mechanism to counter tanking and, you know, finding ways to get players more money earlier in their careers.
Just for clarification, the Players Association withdrawing their proposal for a more liberalized free agency. They wanted it to go to, well, in a general sense, 5 years from where it is now, 6 years. They also lowered the proposed decrease in revenue sharing. Is that essentially of great significance? It's certainly more significant than the liberalized free agent, as you said, because the players knew the owners were not going to do that anyway. So that's one of those, it's a strategy in all negotiation. You throw a few things out there that you don't really want or don't really expect to get. But then when you take them back off the table, you say, well, now you got to take something back, right? But where do you think they are on this this rev share situation? How important is it?
So I had a conversation with someone yesterday about on the player side, and we're talking about like, how do you really address tanking, right? And, you know, the Jason Stark has had an idea that, you know, some people really like, where you reward the teams with the better draft picks who just finished out of the playoffs, right? So that you create an incentive to compete. But to me, that one, it's a great idea. And I think there's certainly some sort of place for that. But you also have to find a way to allow teams who are not good to have access at the best players, right? So that you can kind of create winning and losing cycles again. And the way I think, or one of the better ways to eliminate tanking or counter tanking, is by eliminating revenue sharing, because revenue sharing has essentially allowed teams to go into these extended tanking sessions where they just,
like Pittsburgh, Kansas City,
Pittsburgh and Baltimore, and right, you know, Florida for a while, Kansas City for a while, where, you know, you really bottom out, you're not spending on players, and you're still not suffering a financial penalty because you're getting so much in revenue sharing that you can take the poor gates for a few years and still make your money. Now, if you eat away at that money, then all of a sudden teams are like, oh, we have to be presentable because we need people in our stadium to make money. And I think that's a real way to incentivize competing and incentivizing. You know, the school of thought is that for a long time has been like, there is no point in finishing, you know, in the 10 to 20 range. You're either, if you're in the top 10 teams, okay, it makes sense. You're on the cusp of competing. You're in the bottom 10, okay, you're getting the better draft picks. And if you're in the middle, you're kind of nowhere. And how do you create an incentive to get back into that, you know, middle ground where, you know, it's better to win 75 games than it is to win 66? Because, well, you're going to get more people in seats.
Sorry, one of the things that's on the table is increase in playoff participants. And the players are essentially holding back on that. I'm not saying they're against it, because I don't know that they are, but they want fewer playoff teams, they say. Isn't that a way to incentivize teams to spend more money?
Yeah, the counter argument to that, and I kind of see it, but then I also kind of don't, in that is that if there are 14 spots to make the playoffs, and you were going to be sort of in that 10 to 14 range, or 11, 12, 13, 14, well, maybe now you're not going to push as aggressively, because you're like, all right, I'm probably making the playoffs now. And then, you know, is it really going to incentivize the teams who are going to be, say, 15 to 20 to spend more money? Or are they going to be like, well, maybe we'll fluke it in and there's so many more spots, and that kind of mentality creeps in, and then, you know, all of a sudden you've lowered the barrier entry, so teams are like, oh, I don't have to spend as much. So that would be the reason there's some caution around that. So, you know, I do think that, sort of done right, with maybe a reduction in revenue sharing so that you don't subsidize extended periods of losing, combined with the incentive of expanded playoffs, that might be a combo that makes a difference in tanking. But, you know, I think the one thing that everybody is cautious about in CBAs is that whatever you put into writing, whatever you put into practice, you know, there, and especially if it's dramatically different, you know, that becomes facts on the ground that you have to deal with for years and years after. And just like some of the other things in previous years, they may have unintended consequences that skew the balance towards one side or the other.
Well, the other simplicity of that, Shai, is if as a player we are going to give in to allowing more teams in the playoffs, well, what are we getting in return? This is a tit for tat scenario. They may like the idea, but, you know, behind closed doors within the players' group, they've got to be saying, okay, we like it, but you know what? We're not going to give it for free. We need something in return to give. And I mean, that's the simplicity of collective bargaining. What are you going to give to get back?
Right. And this is the major card that the players hold right now, right? This, like, the owners definitely want it. It's worth a lot of money to them. It's worth some money to the players too, but not as much as it is to the owners. And so what can they get in exchange for that? And I think that the clear priority is something that alleviates or something that pays players younger in their career, so that, you know, what, they're not these incredible bargains when they're performing through their pre-RB years and even in their RB years. Something that addresses that. And then secondarily to that, it's like, how do you, you know, like, tanking is an issue for the game. It's an issue for owners too, whether they want to accept that or not. in collective bargaining, it's a real problem, because you're essentially, you can't keep going into seasons with four teams, five teams, eight teams saying, yeah, we're punting and we're going to be a terrible product to watch. Like, that's not good. That's not healthy for your game.
Yes.
Tell that to the people in Houston. Tell that to the people in Houston. Because how many years did they tank? And look at them. Now they're a juggernaut.
Right.
And they're great.
Yeah, right. But look at Pittsburgh.
Right.
Who have been crap for 20 years and don't seem to have no intention of being Colorado. Anything but.
Right. You know, the Colorado, Arizona, there are lots of examples where it goes wrong. Right. Like tanking isn't a guarantee. And Baltimore, you know, Baltimore may turn
it. Baltimore is the best example.
If they've got a great farm system, but you know, when are they going to leverage it? And they've been, it's also, I guess, like, you know, how much are you willing to sacrifice? Like, you know, it, with Houston, it was three very, very bad years. You know, Detroit's been bad for quite a few years now, and maybe they're now just starting to turn the corner. But you've been unwatchable. Like, Baltimore's literally unwatchable. You know, you can watch Cedric Mullins, you can watch John Means. You know, I like Anthony Santander a little bit, but you know, they're just, Ryan Mountcastle's interesting, but there's just not a lot to watch. Like, they're a tough team to watch. And you know, if you have like that, where a season where your team goes sideways, and it happens, right, where plans go awry, but this is intentional. Like, this is purposeful avoidance of talent, because you don't want to spend money in order to finish in with a higher draft pick. You know, that's corrosive in your game. And I think that's the distinction. And it's important. I think it's an important issue. Like, if more of your teams are competing and more of your teams are in the mix, then you're going to have a bigger fan base, and a bigger fan base ultimately means more money. So I think that's where the incentive lies for both parties. But you know, right now it's a card for the owners to play, just as, you know, expanded playoffs are a card for the players to play.
Well, listen, the easiest answer to this, you know, minimal payroll, raise them, you know, mandate a minimum amount you have to spend. Well, the National Hockey League has it.
That sounds like a salary cap and a salary floor. And I think baseball's always prided itself in never having a cap, right, Shai?
That's it. You know, I think, Bob, I agree with you. Like, the salary minimum makes a ton of sense. But, I mean, I've never heard it tied or suggested without the salary floor on top of it, right? If you're going to have an artificial inflation on the bottom, you're going to have an artificial deflation at the top. That's right. Sort of the bargain that you make for that.
Well, but the Players Association in all sports, traditionally, unintentionally perhaps, but recognizing that they're doing it, creates systems where the rich get richer and the poor don't get richer. You know, you cannot argue the amount of spending that took place just before the lockout by teams. And it was all at the top end. Mm-hmm. It's all top end free agents who are making ridiculous amounts of money.
Yep.
And I think everybody would understand that. Why the Players Association doesn't focus entirely on the minimum salary or some kind of structure that mandates payroll increases on an annual basis, whether it's based on performance or not, has always been a puzzlement to me. Or even offering, maybe they have and I just haven't paid attention, offering some kind of rev share within the Players Association, where a guy who's making $30 million has to kick $1 million back to the other guys. Either you're in it together or you're not in it together. I mean, they're in it together selectively.
I mean, if Scott Boras was here, he might think that you've been delving a little too much into some Karl Marx there, Bob.
Well, but I'm not.
I understand what you're saying. No, it's a reasonable question, and I think let's kind of take a step back. So, yes, I do think they're trying to address the minimum salary, and they're understanding that, you know, part of the incentive in the tanking system is that young players are super cheap, right? Like if you've got a player in the 0 to 3 service time range and they're making, you know, between, you know, around $600,000 a year, give or take, you know, why would you spend $1.5 million on somebody who might be marginally better, if at all, just because they're a little bit more of a known commodity, and you control that young player, you can move him up and down. So if he's not performing, you're not even guaranteed to pay the $600,000, and you can just flip up another $600,000 lottery ticket. So, you know, that I think is what one of the reasons why they have to find ways to get their younger players paid more. But I think the other thing, the other tenet, at least in Major League Baseball, has always been, it's, we want to get players to an open market where the open market will decide their value. And that has been why so much focus in the past, you think back to Kurt Flood's battle for free agency and all those things, allow players to get to the market and teams to bid whatever they deserve. And that's when you get the mega contracts. And that has been the foundational principle, not protecting guys in the 0 to 6 service time category.
Well, correct me if I'm wrong, but the Players Association have said that they really are concerned about the middle class. I mean, we call it the middle class. They are concerned about the $4 million player. Yes. And trying to make sure that he gets his equal share as his career goes along. The fascination for me is that it takes, I want to go back to something you talked about with the tanking, because I understand the NBA draft. It's 2 rounds, and you can get a player that can make your starting five and make a difference next year. You can do the same thing with a starting quarterback in the NFL. You can do the same for 4 or 5 players in the NHL. That doesn't happen in Major League Baseball. It takes you how long to develop that player? I mean, the Major League Baseball draft is a lottery at best. How many rounds is it? Like 52?
No, now it's down to 40.
Oh, sorry. Sorry.
I mean, in theory, they've shortened it the past couple of years because of the pandemic. So we'll see what it looks like.
But you know what I mean, Shai. Yeah, I mean, 100%. We're talking, when you talk about teams tanking, they're not going to be a contender next year.
Right. But see, John, the piece that is missing, and this is something that came into the CBA in the 2011-2012, when you had the firmer bonus pools for teams in the draft. And what happens is you get the higher up you pick in the draft, the more money you get to spend. And so when you have more money to spend within the draft, well, then, you know, that you can maybe buy out that high school player who really wants to go to college and get him into your system. And you can maybe get an extra player or two, or if someone is asking for too much money at a certain spot for one team to manage, but you have more bonus pool space, you can manipulate your pool and bring in more elite talents. And what you want to do in baseball draft, because of how volatile it is, John, is just get as many of those lottery tickets in there. And so, you know, you get 6 or 7 guys, you know, one or two of them may hit, but you only get really 1 or 2 guys. Well, you know, your odds of being successful are much lower. So that is why the tanking is so advantageous. It's not just, I mean, partly it's picking up higher. And like, you know, if you look at, you know, the players in the major leagues, they're overwhelmingly from the first 3 rounds of the draft. All like it's a staggering percentage of them who make it. And then you get more money to spend. So you get more shots at finding that talented player.
We won't take a break, but you know, I'm intrigued by this notion of a floor, and how can you create a salary floor without actually creating one or necessitating a ceiling to counterbalance it? And I got some thoughts on that. I don't know whether they're valid or not, but we'll see if Shai agrees. Shai Davidi is with us. We'll come back after these messages. We're with Shai Davidi of SportsCenter's Bob McCallum's John Shannon with you. So let's address this notion by the Players Association that among the many things they want more teams to be competitive. They want teams who traditionally, as we said before, don't spend a lot of money and don't try and win and still make money. They want them to be mandated to spend some money. So you don't want to create a floor, because then you probably have to have a ceiling, as you have in other sports where there's a cap. Let me start with this, a two-part question, but let me start with this. Do you think the arbitration system works right now? Economically.
I guess it works for both sides. I think the mechanics of it are antiquated, and what they're valuing isn't reflective of how players are valued in free agency. So you get paid for different things in arbitration than you do in free agency. And that's probably not a wise thing for your sport.
Okay. So now let's talk about what traditionally these perennial losers do. And we talked about Florida, Pittsburgh, Arizona, Kansas City, and there's others. Do they traditionally trade their young players in anticipation of them getting big raises that they don't want to pay through arbitration?
Sometimes, and the players from a trade value perspective, you know, they start declining once you have fewer years left. So, you know, if a player's got, you know, two full seasons of arbitration left, that's sort of a good time to trade him if you don't see yourself contending in the next couple of years.
All right. What about putting some limitation on that? Making, at least limiting, if not eliminating, the possibility of trading a player before he completes his 6 years, before he goes into free agency, or before he goes into a year of arbitration. Would that be helpful?
Well, I mean, I'm not sure necessarily if it would be, but you'd also be tying both teams and players' hands, right? Like, there are sometimes still baseball deals that get made, right? Where it's, you know, I need a pitcher, you need a second baseman. These guys are roughly in the same category. You know, you're eliminating that type of trade from happening by putting such a limitation. And two, sometimes, you know, what happens if you've got the change of scenery guy or the made redundant guy and who gets stuck in a situation and he can't be traded? So while you would potentially maybe be solving one problem, I think you'd be creating a few others in a way that would be detrimental to both team and player.
Well, what about the NBA system where essentially there has to be an equalization within a trade, an economic equalization within a trade? And I know that's much more difficult in baseball because quite often you'll see a veteran player making $20 million and he's traded for five guys who aren't even in the major leagues. So you're going to have to put some kind of evaluation on that. But do you think that could work?
Again, I think if you're doing that, then how are you, you know, like, I think there are times where it's legitimate for you to make the prospect for veteran trade, right? Both ways.
Sure.
So if you want to acquire that guy, you, and you're a team that's in contending, you don't want to have to sacrifice roster players to make additions just to meet a number. And I think the other thing is, you know, the reason that there are those financial equalizations in the other leagues, it's to make the cap work, right? So there's no cap element in baseball. And so, you know, I think if you took the cap dynamic out of the other leagues, you'd never have those kind of deals because you don't have the need for the financial equalization.
Well, there's some truth in that, except that in the NBA, for example, you can't exceed the cap, but you're going to pay a financial penalty.
Yeah.
And we all know that there are teams that are perfectly willing to do that. No, just
because
as
they
there
make
are teams
so much
in baseball.
Money. Because they make
there
so
are teams
much money.
In baseball that will go over the cap.
For sure.
You know, that, because they don't care. The Dodgers have done it for years and years and years. The Yankees, I don't know whether they are now, but they did it for a long time. So did the Red Sox. And they weren't inhibited by that, it didn't seem.
Yeah, see, I mean,
the fascination for me, Shai, is like why are we going through this right now? I can understand the players trying to protect the rights of those younger players and the middle class players. What are the owners? I mean, is this a simplification to say that the owners just want to make more money?
Well, I mean, well, yes, to a degree, but it's also that the players have lost ground over the course of the last three CBAs. And it's been very progressive. But if you look at some of the broader revenue trends, and obviously, you know, 2021 have been impacted by the pandemic, so you can't necessarily take that as gospel. But the trend lines were such that the player collective share of revenue had been declining. And we've seen a lot of trends in the market that have led to that, right? We're seeing the middle class of players largely eliminated because, frankly, a lot of teams are just smarter in terms of how they're spending money in free agency. You know, you're not seeing the mega deals for the, you know, good player, but, you know, was Ian Desmond worth his contract? Probably not. And, you know, the players of that ilk, the middle class player who got overpaid, you know, we're starting to see some elimination of that. And, you know, as a result, you know, free agency has changed. So players aren't getting paid, or not enough players are getting paid when they get to free agency. And they're such bargains earlier in their career that their value is being suppressed, especially during their 0 to 3 years, but at times in, you know, 4, 5, 6 as well, that, you know, the players are like, well, we need to correct this. And we need to find ways to get money to players earlier in their career. And we need to find a way to claw back some of the revenue we've lost.
Well, I know John will acknowledge that I've said this for a long, long period of time. And in many, many occasions, maybe you too. I've said it particularly about hockey. And my quote is, I would not have anybody on my roster, not one player on my roster, whose salary started with the number 5. Not one. I either want guys who make more than that or less than that. Because the 5 guy is the middle class guy who isn't good enough to make $5 million and should be eliminated, but teams constantly do it. And partly they're almost psychologically forced to do it because of the system. And I think the exact same thing is true in baseball. And to fight that argument on the part by the Players Association is absolutely crazy. Because in baseball, I wouldn't have a $5 million guy either.
Right.
I simply wouldn't. I'd rather have one more superstar and 3 more rookies making the minimum than I would a guy who's making $5 million. At the end of the day, I'm spending about the same amount of money, but the impact is going to be greater for me.
Right.
Agree or disagree?
No, I think as a general principle, it makes sense. Now, there are going to be times where, you know, you need that middle class guy too, right? Like, I think on a hockey roster where, you know, your everything is more set, right? In terms of, you know, these guys are your scorers, these guys are your checkers, these guys are your physical grind guys, that you can, the salary slotting is a little bit different. You know, in baseball, just because of the nature of the game, there are going to be times where you need a Steve Pierce to come in and, you know, play 85 games for you. And, you know, that $5 or $6 million player is worthwhile for that stretch of time, you know, like, you know, the Justin Smokes of the world and things of that nature that can give you decent production just because of the way the game is, 162 games, you know, the 9 innings, you're 9 deep. There's just, there are times where you need to raise your floor. And so, you're going to have some of those middle class players. I think what happened though is that too many of those middle class players started getting paid towards star status, and then you got a lot of bad contracts on the books. And then
bingo,
and that's when a team gets into trouble. So in principle, you're right, and that's what really we've seen in free agency the past few years. Like, the star players are still getting paid, right? Anyone who's a rare, like if you're a pitcher. As starting pitcher, especially, can go 6 innings, you're still getting paid, even if you're mediocre, because there aren't a lot of you. But beyond that, you know, a lot of the other players have gotten squeezed, and I think that's part of what the Players Association is concerned with, and saying, okay, if you're going to squeeze these players then, well, then at least pay them at the beginning.
But you know, I'd love to be a fly on the wall in the Mets clubhouse when Max Scherzer's sitting there at what, $42-43 million, and there's a guy making $700,000 down two stalls away. But that, to me, to Bob's point earlier on, is player to player. How do you justify that? And how do the players justify that?
But that's an internal argument that is not being addressed by the Players Association. And they won't address it, but it should be there. I think it should be their issue, you know, and I mean, I know it's Marxism, communism, you know, everybody should make, I'm not saying everybody should make the same, but if that is such a big issue, then is it unreasonable to ask a player making $30 million to give 3% of his salary into some kind of a pool that will be given to whoever you think deserves it, whoever the Players Association thinks should get it. And I hearken back to an NBA lockout where the commissioner came on my show, the radio show, and said, you remember what he said, John?
Well, his quote was, you can fill in the blank, but his quote was, just watch me.
the quote he had before was, you know, we were talking about the issues at hand. And he said, we have $5 billion we're prepared to give the players. We don't care who gets it. You can give it to Michael Jordan was playing at the time, and he was clearly the best player in the game, probably the best player in history. And he said, give it all to Michael Jordan, give some to Michael Jordan, give half to Michael Jordan, have it split up equally among all the players in the NBA. I don't care. But the total number is $5 billion. And you know what? It was one of the most intriguing things I've ever heard anybody in a negotiation say. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, it's your responsibility as the Players Association really to decide how your membership wants to get paid. It shouldn't necessarily be ours. Your thoughts on that?
I mean, I think that's a byproduct of having a cap system where the amount of money available is finite, right? And in theory, in Major League Baseball, the amount of revenue that owners may choose to spend on players is not finite, right? You may say, your team may say, okay, our budget this year is $100 million, but all of a sudden they've got an opportunity to get a player and it's going to cost them an extra $7 million. You can go to your ownership and say, look, this is a huge opportunity for us. Let's spend this extra $7 million because this player is going to make a difference for us. Mm-hmm. And if you're Major League Baseball, that's what you want. You want, if you're the players, excuse me, that's what you want. You want a system where the amount of money isn't finite. And then it's not up to, you know, the players to decide how they distribute the money. It's up to the teams to decide, okay, we're going to spend this on players, on this player because this is his worth, and we're going to spend this on player because this is his worth. And obviously that changes because of the system, right? You know, Max Scherzer can get to that massive number because he's a free agent and the bidding for him takes him there. Whereas if you're Juan Soto would make $50 million a year if teams could bid him up right now, but he can't because he's in arbitration. So until he gets to that point, he's going to have to work within the confines of the system. So the idea of it is like, here's X amount of dollars, you split it. You know, Major League Baseball has tried to do that. And what they want ideally is the players fighting amongst themselves, which in a sense is kind of what the revenue sharing offer is from the player side. It's like, hey, owners, why don't you fight about amongst yourselves? Because Yankees, do you really want to pay for the Pirates to keep tanking? Dodgers, do you really want to subsidize the Rays and
no, you know the answer there though. The right. Answer there, Shai, is we don't care.
Oh, the owners actually do.
Like they don't really because they make enough money already. The Dodgers and the Yankees.
You can always make more money, Bob, and you can guarantee that one of the things that Rob Manfred has to do, maybe keeps him as busy as anything, is keeping the owners who are having their pockets dug into by the poorer cousins. You can make sure it's about keeping them on side for them.
Yeah, but you're addressing the wrong. I think you're addressing the wrong teams. Teams like the Dodgers and the Yankees, who are willing to pay the luxury tax, are not going to be concerned about how much they give the Pittsburgh Pirates. There are plenty of teams who spend a percentage, half of what those big teams spend, who give handouts to those teams. They're the guys, yes, who would complain. I just don't think the Dodgers and the Yankees and the Red Sox and the handful of, not even a handful of other teams really care about that. But go
well, ahead. The other time the owners complain about the owners is when one of those revenue receiving teams gets into the free agent market and starts bidding against the teams with the big money, that they end up jacking up the price on the free agents. I mean, that it's an interesting system. Where, by the way, where is the Players Association? Where is the league on term on deals? Do we hear anything about length of contracts at all in this discussion?
I mean, they've generally, the past few at least, have gone 5 years, and yeah. I'd expect it to probably be in that range. I think it's enough time to assess a system. I think if you go shorter than that, you know, you're not really able to make, you don't have enough of a sample to say, okay, this is how this system's working. This is not based on aberrations. And longer than that, then you risk locking in something that you may not be comfortable with.
So the calendar moves ahead. We're now into the last week of the month of January, a time when teams would normally be preparing for the start of spring training, when pitchers would be throwing, at least on their own, if not usually in camps. You're starting to get ready for the start of the season. How close are we to spring training being delayed? How close are we to opening day being delayed?
I mean, we're really close to spring. I mean, you think typically the report dates for spring training are, you know, around Valentine's Day, right? February 12th, February 13th, February 15th, something in that range. And, there's not a lot of time, because not only do you have to, you know, just get players settled and let them book their travel and all this and book their homes for spring training, you know, you also have to finish the off season, right? I talked to someone yesterday, said, oh, I've been preparing arbitration cases and I don't know when I'm going to be able to argue these cases. Right. So, you know, you've got to get through arbitration. You've got to finish free agency. You've got to get all these other contracts done. There's still a ton of business. So, you know, we're pretty close right now. We're butting right up against a delay to the start of spring training. I personally don't think either side really cares about that. Like if spring training started March 1st or March 5th or even March 7th, I still think they'd find a way to shoehorn everything in and get ready for opening day, you know, but I do think that the traditional spring training start is very much under threat and looking increasingly less likely.
We've talked about this many times, that, you know, this generation of players, this is the first time they've been through what I would describe as a labor dispute. Do you get a sense of nervousness, panic from the players at this point, or is there still trust in what Tony and everybody are doing with the players, with the union?
You know, the closer we're getting to the delay of spring training, then we'll start seeing. I think right now everybody's still, okay, we're trusting the process. Nobody's sacrificed a thing yet, right?
Yeah,
and
right.
Once the actual losses begin, you know, we'll see how people start feeling about it. But, you know, again, there's always, if you're young, you're probably like, okay, this is important to me. I got a lot to gain from this. Whereas if you're older, you're like, well, man, I already took a hit in 2020 when I only made, you know, 30 something percent of my salary. And like now I'm going to potentially lose more salary. Like I don't want to lose any more money. So let's get this done.
We got to get out of here. We'll watch with great interest and see how this thing evolves. And I don't doubt for a second we'll have more conversations before it is settled. Thank you, Shai, as always.
Pleasure, boys. And hopefully we don't have to talk about more. I mean, this may be the only thing less fun than talking about COVID is. So you know, hopefully we can move off this pretty soon.
Shai Davidi from Sportsnet. We'll be back after this. We are back. Thanks to Shai Davidi of Sportsnet for joining us. And I don't know. I, you know, we've been through, you and I are old enough. We've been through
too many of these
in all sports. Do you have a feeling that we're going to have a work stoppage?
I sense that there will be a delay of some sort, and I wouldn't be surprised.
Spring training delay or regular season delay?
I'll go to the extent of spring training delay. I mean, you've always believed, I think too, that spring training's too long anyway.
It's way too long.
So they're playing with house money in many ways right now to find a way to get finished. And, you know, what regular season is supposed to start March 30th, April 1st, you know, they'll get 162 games in starting then, I think, and we'll go from there. But I remember with the Curt Flood stuff, Catfish Hunter, the 70s, the labor disputes, all that stuff, free agency, that was one of a kind. That was special. That was different. You know, the amount of labor disputes, Bob, we have been through now in all four major leagues in North America, the NFL probably less than any of the others. You just grow tired of it. You grow tired of it.
There's a whole generation, John, that hasn't really seen this.
Oh, I know. I know.
To see this every two or three years.
The sports would compare and say, well, what are you doing in your sport? There's a law firm in New York, Proskauer Rose.
Yep.
And a guy named Bob Batterman was the longtime senior counsel there. And they were the law firm on the league side of labor disputes. And they represented and talked for all four sports. And so they were designing so much of this stuff in order to try to protect the owners and their revenues. I know it's a fact of life. But you'd much rather be talking about, you know, strikes and balls and goals and assists and touchdowns and field goals and 3-point plays than you would be any of this stuff. But it's become so routine now in so many ways over the last 25 or 30 years.
Well, one of the things that I thought a bit about, and we're not in a position to, it's not worth contemplating, was if the owners had limitations on attendance, or if fans couldn't go to games, don't you think the prospect of a prolonged lockout would just go on and on and on?
Exponentially.
Yeah. And right now, the only team at any risk is the Toronto Blue Jays.
Yeah.
Because there won't be another team in Major League Baseball that has any limitations, I don't think, on how many people can attend games. Having said that, Major League Baseball is clearly not encumbered by attendance economically. A significant portion of their revenue comes extraneous of attendance in most cases.
Baseball very discreetly. For the regular fan, baseball has done a better job of morphing itself into a digital business.
Correct.
And so what used to be baseball and media, BAM, put so much money in the team's pockets that that secondary income has become so vital to the teams and other leagues are so jealous of what baseball has done in the last 15 years with when it comes to revenue streams.
Well, the NFL isn't.
Although I'll tell you what, I there are some parts of the model that baseball has created in revenue streams in media that I do think the NFL is saying, yeah, we want that too. And then we could have more.
Well, the NBA is not, is still impacted by attendance. The National Hockey League relies on attendance, not in every market.
50% now, though. 50% of the revenue is still attendance driven.
Yeah. Well, and if you had to play an entire season with nobody in the building, you wouldn't do it.
No, that's right.
And we've seen it across this country.
And so how do you justify? I mean, you know, we're going to be talking about what's gone on the last 2 years with nobody in the building and the players getting paid their full salaries. We're going to be talking about this in hockey from a hockey perspective for the next 6 years, in my opinion, as the players, all their money gets clawed back in escrow because they negotiated a deal where they said they get paid full salaries during COVID.
Yeah.
But they will pay it back at a certain point. And that's going to happen, Bob. You know, we're going to see that in the NHL. We're not going to necessarily see it in other sports. And as when Shai was talking about, well, players said, well, I only got 30% of my salary. Well, yeah, but it's, you know, everybody suffered during the pandemic. Everybody did. They still got lots of money.
Well, we'll see how this resolves itself. I'm of the opinion that I don't see, and I could be 100% wrong, but based on having covered, I don't know how many of these financial battles.
Yeah.
It's more than 10. I don't know. I don't know how much, maybe it's 20. I don't see a Stonewall issue. I don't know about you. I mean, I don't see one issue that is so problematic that it may take a long time for them to figure out a solution.
Hard to have a solution or a problem when players, the high-end players, are making that much money still, Bob. It really is.
The union is supposed to be about all.
Yeah. Yeah. And owners are socialists. So.
Well, look, we understand the, you know, or you should understand, we call them a union. They prefer to be called an association more often than not. But all you have to do is look at the definition of a union and what the premise of that definition is. And that is fairness for all employees. And I don't know how you do that when you've got some guys making 600,000 and another guy making 40 million.
You do call them an association then, because it ain't a union.
It isn't a union. You're absolutely 100% right. And that's my point. We're going to stay with baseball, I think, tomorrow. Yes.
Hall of Fame ballot.
We always enjoy those days. You get a chance to debate the relative merits of the guys that got in and those that did not. And, you know, the cheater era is coming to an end for the most part. So we'll engage in that discussion tomorrow as we stick with baseball for another day. We thank you for watching or listening, as the case may be. For John Shannon, Bob McCowan, see you tomorrow.